You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 9th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, this is The Globalist, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead, as the scene is set for another Trump-Biden battle in November, we'll ask a veteran Democratic comms and campaign specialist how he views the coming election. The diplomatic fallout between Ecuador and Mexico is intensifying. We'll have more detail on the issues between the two nations. And what to do if a country runs out of money? Zimbabwe, which has the highest inflation rate in the world, has just scrapped the currency and invented a new one. An economist tells us about the country's economic zigzag and the new zimzig. Plus,
I'm Sheena Rossiter, contributing editor for Monocle in Western Canada. Today, I'll have the latest on climate news, where we talk about record-breaking rising temperatures, Canada's new carbon tax, and how the solar eclipse went over in North America.
And we'll look at how the tide is turning against the military junta in Myanmar and have a flick through the papers. And then,
we were surprised at how well the sector bounced back, both in terms of the people who are willing to invest and the travellers who are coming to our hotels.
We'll examine the future of the hospitality industry. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. Hamas has rejected an Israeli ceasefire proposal made at talks in Cairo, and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said a date was set for an invasion of Rafah, but didn't reveal when. The US ambassador to the United Nations will travel to the heavily armed Korean border and meet North Korean defectors in South Korea amid faltering UN efforts to ensure sanctions enforcement against the North. And Russia and China will continue to cooperate in the fight against terrorism as part of their ever-strengthening relationship, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said in Beijing today. Do stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on those stories. Now, we're 7 months out from a US presidential election, which will likely pit the incumbent Democratic President Joe Biden against former President Republican Donald Trump in what's seen as a hugely consequential poll. I'm joined now by Mark Edelman, who's a long-standing campaign and communications consultant to US Democrats. Mark, it's lovely to have you back in the studio.
Thank you.
In Europe, this is viewed as a global fight for democracy, and there's real concern that Trump will win. But what's the temperature in the United States?
Well, I think we share that. It's a fight really for what the United States is about, how it should operate, what its existence means both to Americans and to its place around the world.
And the polls, I mean, they seem to shift often. How reliable are they?
Well, look, polls are literally snapshots in time. It's literally the moment you take that poll, it's and read the results, it's outdated already. It can show you trend lines. It can certainly show you where people's headspace is. But we've got a long time for people to actually, you know, go into an election booth or vote from home as we do legally in many places in the country now. And so I would not spin on the polls as much as I know it's hard not to. But they're very, you know, they're not all polls are created equal.
Yeah. I mean, for instance, we're seeing some polls saying that as many as 20% of black voters are supporting Trump. Given his racist rhetoric, that seems extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. And that's certainly a trend line that is very concerning. I think that onus is on the Biden administration and the Biden campaign to certainly point out all of the things that they have done over the last 3 years, which has been, by any estimation, a very successful presidency. And you start to look at what those issues that the president was able to get passed, from bills to laws and presidential declarations that he was able to make, have made lives better for everyday Americans, no matter your race or creed. And so, you know, they will do a better job. And I think we are all of the school of thought that we need to be out there every day telling voters what Joe Biden has done for you, why Joe Biden has been one of the most successful presidents since FDR and LBJ, and what it would mean if Joe Biden wasn't president in January of 2025.
Mm. And how is the media reflecting that?
Well, look, I think what I think, this is my personal opinion, I think, you know, still we as a global media industry have not wholly figured out how to cover Donald Trump. And you saw what happened in 2016, and you saw what happened in 2020, and now there's almost been, in my estimation, an overcorrection. We're not going to take that feed. We're not going to take his remarks in full because they're lies. They're not reflective of anything that's actually happening. They are propaganda in the most propaganda kind of way. And I think that the president, obviously, who's out and about every day, I mean, the truth of it is you don't see Donald Trump every day. You may see him every few days, and most of those times are in a courtroom. And so, you know, for Biden, he's out every single day. And, you know, from a media standpoint, that's not always the most interesting. But it's important to hear what he is saying, what his surrogates are saying. And I think for the media to hopefully figure out how to reconcile this, being able to sort of walk and chew gum at the same time.
What are the biggest campaign issues? I mean, abortion, obviously.
Well, abortion is huge. And you just saw this weekend and yesterday specifically, where Donald Trump continues to say in private, Roe v. Wade was overturned because of me. He says it with glee and with great, you know, joie. And the truth of it is that is a consequence that we are feeling every day in 26 states now. A woman cannot get an abortion. And this is creating all sorts of problems that we know macro. I don't think we even understand micro in people's lives. The idea that the United States has never been a country that's taken away rights from people, and the idea that we can now criminalize and send women and families back into the dark ages. President Trump yesterday said he believes it's a state right. Well, that was what Roe v. Wade did. It took a state-by-state right in 1973 and made it a national enshrined law that no matter where you went in the United States, you had access to women's health and an abortion. And so when you start to think about all the things that extrapolate from that, most women don't even know they're pregnant by 6 weeks. Mm. Forget about, you don't even know whatever complications you might have till 12, 15 weeks. And not that I'm here to, you know, sort of get into a full, strong discussion of choice, because there are much better people to do that than me. But, you know, this is not the country I was born into. And this is something that will radically change the lives of young women, older women, and men. It's insane.
Do you think that the election, regardless of how people vote and how they're influenced on these big issues like abortion, do you think that it can be free and fair, or is there such a large chance of outside influence from, for instance, Russia?
Listen, that's better asked of a cybersecurity kind of expert. What I would say is that I think over the last few years, certainly when President Biden came to office post January 6th, there has been a real move for integrity in our elections in a way that I don't think was being paid attention to before. And what is interesting, while it is a quote unquote national election, every state runs their own election. And so we've had people in states like Arizona, like Wisconsin, like Michigan and Pennsylvania, who I think have done a very good job of trying to hole up the sort of vulnerabilities that people are afraid of. Look, voter fraud is very rare, and it became, you know, again, one of the things that sort of Donald Trump demagogued over the last few years. But elections are very safe. And, you know, where I think as a country we need to work on is getting more access for people to vote, to make it easier to vote. And, you know, I'll leave the cybersecurity to the experts, but more people voting is better.
Finally, Mark, you mentioned January the 6th. If Donald Trump loses, will he accept the result? I mean, could this be, I don't want to be alarmist, but could you have a civil war scenario?
Well, let's hope not. But I think you're seeing the sort of soiling of those oats right now. Trump has already been introducing into his rhetoric that if he doesn't win, it's not fair and that something is amiss. Again, I think this is, you know, where certain states that have, you know, certainly the swing states have worked very hard to try and create as much election integrity as possible. But look, this is a certainly a manifestation of where the country is as far as how they see elections right now. And there's been a lot of undermining of that over the last few years. And I guess I would leave you with, like, watch, you know, what the president says and talks about. President Biden, of course, because this is something that he is sacrosanct on. Everybody should be able to vote. Everybody gets one vote. This isn't Chicago in the 1960s. And so, you know, we really, I think, as campaign professionals, need to make sure people do vote. Because what you're talking about is what happens when people vote and it's not counted. I'm less concerned with that. My concern is that we don't get people to show up because all of this is about one day in November. That's what it's all about for all the money, all the rhetoric, and we got to get people to show up and vote.
Mark Edelman, thank you very much. This is The Globalist. It is 7:12 here in London, and that is 1:12 in Quito. The diplomatic spat between Mexico and Ecuador deepened over the weekend after police forcibly broke into Mexico's embassy in Quito to detain former Ecuadorian Vice President Jorge Glass. Mexico has now suspended diplomatic ties with Ecuador. Well, I'm joined by Andrew Thompson, who's a journalist and a political risk analyst specialising in Latin America. Andrew, thanks for coming on the programme. What's the background to this? Why was Glass in the embassy?
The background is that Glass has been facing a number of corruption charges and has various cases open against him. He was released on parole and he went to the Mexican embassy and requested political asylum. After some considerations, the Mexican government granted him asylum, which the Ecuadorian president deeply disagrees with. So he ordered police in. They basically pushed their way into the embassy, seized the former vice president and took him off to prison.
So I wonder if you could just give us a little snapshot of Ecuador at present, because it was once seen as this island of peace in the region, but violence under the control of drug trafficking organisations has been really increasing. How has President Daniel Noboa dealt with that? And how does this play into the embassy raid?
I think I can start to answer that question by taking you on a slight detour to El Salvador in Central America, where the existing president has imposed an incredibly hardline anti-drug gang policy, arrested large numbers of people, and emerged extremely popular. So this is something the president's called Nayib Bukele. People are talking about Bukelismo, a kind of hardline anti-crime stance, which has proven, at least in El Salvador's case, very politically successful for the president. So Noboa in Ecuador, looking at El Salvador, wants to adopt the same kind of approach. And initially, at least, it seems that he too has been quite successful. So he took office last November, very quickly declared a state of emergency and, in fact, a state of internal war, and launched a big attack on all the drug gangs who have been operating in Ecuador. And this has got him popularity ratings in opinion polls of 80% plus. In his view, it's an attack not only on the drug gangs, but also on the corrupt political establishment. Noboa is an outsider. He's the son of the most wealthiest man in Ecuador. So he's kind of got a business approach to things. And he is, if you like, trying to build up this image that he is decisive, and he doesn't mind, you know, clashing with convention, for example, ignoring diplomatic immunity.
Mm. And there are also tensions concerning the election results. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador has been commenting about the legitimacy of the result. What's the detail on that?
Essentially, López Obrador annoyed Noboa by suggesting that the assassination of the number three candidate in last year's presidential elections basically allowed Noboa to win. So he was kind of implying that you wouldn't have been president if it hadn't have been for the assassination of one of the key candidates. To some extent, you can see the point he was trying to make, but all it did was irritate the Ecuadorian president even more. Mm. So both men are completely at loggerheads.
And I wonder how much of Mexico's reaction to this diplomatic incident is calculated to play into the upcoming elections there.
Well, in fact, there are elections both in Mexico and in Ecuador. In Mexico, there are general elections at the beginning of June, and the government candidate, Claudia Sheinbaum, who's closely associated with the existing president, she calculates she will gain ground by posing as strongly nationalist and rejecting problems caused by right-wing presidents in other parts of the region. In the Ecuadorian case, there are very significant elections coming up on the 21st of April. Well, they're not really elections. It's a referendum designed to give President Noboa greater power. Now, the problem is he may have overstepped himself, because the party of the vice president had been supporting his government and was expected to support Noboa's government in the referendum. But because of the treatment of its former vice president, that party, a center-left party called Citizen Revolution, Revolución Ciudadana, that party will now oppose the government in the referendum. And it could be that, the peak of popularity enjoyed by Noboa will now begin to decline a bit, as Ecuadorians think, well, you know, storming into foreign governments' embassies may not be the best way of pursuing foreign policy.
Mm. And how do those foreign governments, how have they reacted to it? What's been the international pushback on it?
Well, it's, I'd say, almost 90% of the regional governments, including the United States, have condemned what they say is a violation of a treaty on diplomatic immunity, which gives the embassies, it supports the sovereignty of embassies and prevents people invading them, just as Noboa did last weekend. There are some, nuances. The United States wants good relations both with Ecuador and Mexico, so it's urging both parties to hold discussions. An initial meeting of the Organization of American States is likely to be held today to discuss the crisis. And it will be interesting to see whether Noboa sticks to his hard line, which is largely focused on the domestic public opinion, or begins to make some concessions, because Mexico will not lift its break in diplomatic relations easily. It'll probably go on till after the elections.
And how important is it for the two countries to have a good diplomatic relationship?
That's an interesting question. Mexico and Ecuador, they don't have massive trade or other links. So it's not so much about economic interests between the two countries. It's more about, if you like, soft power and diplomacy. So it's, if you like, a battle for regional leadership. And at the moment, it looks as if Mexico's got, pretty much everyone on its side. So, you know, very powerful countries like Brazil, which has the largest economy in Latin America, has come out supporting the Mexican position as well. And interestingly, both right-wing and left-wing governments are supporting Mexico. So left-wing governments such as, you know, Colombia, Brazil, Chile, are all supporting Mexico, but right-wing governments such as Argentina and Uruguay have taken a similar line, saying, you know, diplomatic immunity and the sovereignty of embassy, the sovereignty of embassies must be defended.
Andrew, thank you very much indeed. That's Andrew Thompson there. Now, still to come on the programme.
I was faced with a number of those doom merchants. You know, there's never going to be another Frankfurt Book Fair and it's all dead. And it's come back. And it's a testimony to how human beings want to do business. They want to be face to face, have eye contact, be in the same room.
We'll check into the Hyatt to hear how the group's portfolio is taking a more rounded approach to hospitality. This is The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Twenty-two minutes past the top of the hour, you're listening to The Globalist on Monocle Radio with me, Georgina Godwin. And we'll continue now with today's newspapers. Joining me in the studio is Yossi Meckelberg, who's Associate Fellow with the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House. Good morning to Yossi.
Good morning.
We are going to start off with Haaretz, which is this Israeli newspaper. It's been actually an invaluable resource during the war, giving really quite balanced commentary.
Yeah, well, some Israelis will say it's a bit too progressive and liberal for their liking and trying actually to look at both sides. And, you know, I found this fantastic opinion analysis piece by Alon Pinkas, who is a former diplomat, a senior diplomat. And I think there's one sentence that sums up, you know, what the title of this article is: King Midas in Reverse, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Gaza War, and the Art of Value Destruction. And I think it sums up terribly how Israel, from a point of which there was so much sympathy and support of Israel, getting the point that it's so isolated. And he puts a lot of it, naturally, on Prime Minister Netanyahu, and saying one passage that is a prime minister who not only refuses to be held accountable for what happened under his watch, but as the war progressed, he became the sum of all of his failures and epic miscalculations. Mm. And I think in many ways, in one sentence alone, sums up how this war from October 7, 6 months later, as, I don't know if evolved, but mainly regressed into what we see now, that actually Israel has no political, very limited military achievement. And I think it will lick the wounds for many, many, many years as a result of it. And while we have to remember the devastation in Gaza, and the hostages are still in captivity and the negotiation going on. So no strategy, no idea of the day after, what political wants to achieve.
And as Pinker says, it's the art of value destruction.
Yeah, and you could think, and you know, we discuss it, I think, in this studio many times. It's, you know, Israel had the right to respond after October 7th, and there was a casus belli to go after Hamas, but there was no casus belli to go after Gazan people and kill 33,000. And, you know, right now, we don't know exactly, 70-80% of the houses being damaged, and Gaza on the verge of starvation. And also from a political point of view, it goes to a point that so many countries actually impose arms ban on Israel, the UK thinking about it. And only on Thursday, President Biden, in a probably the toughest conversation with an Israeli prime minister, said that the United States considers at least partial arms ban as well. That's not where a prime minister should bring his country.
Absolutely. Let's go to the FT now. Could AUKUS become JAUKUS?
Yeah, apparently. it was a kind of a strange acronym and very difficult, especially in the media, for us to pronounce it, either for the written media. But it's part of the, you know, when talking about the new Cold War, this is part of the representative of this demonstrated that the expansion, if the pillar one of focus was supplying submarines to Australia to be able to deal with China's tendency to expand in this part of the world, even to take small islands and small islets in this. Now the idea, of course, Japan is always a bit more sensitive because they, according to their own constitution, they are not allowed to have a military, but they're allowed to have a defense force, which, you know, it's sometimes it's very difficult to differentiate what is what. But in this idea is, you know, when adding the JAUKUS into this, is the idea a lot of the side of technology, which of course is Japan's, one of its forte, is to end into idea of AI and cybersecurity and cyber, to add also Japan into this, so create this alliance in this part of the world. And I think it's consolidate the American thinking, the NATO thinking, the Western thinking, that the real threat comes right now from China's policies. And if in the past people look at Japan as trying to be an economic expansionist, trying to impose trade agreements, now it's looking into its military expansion. It's not there yet in terms compared to the military power of NATO, for instance, but this is the trajectory and as a result of trying to consolidate this military alliance in this part of the world.
Let's just have a quick look at the Foreign Office here in the UK. Now, Simon Jenkins has a piece in The Guardian saying, even its old boys are turning on the stuffy Foreign Office. They're right to do so. Why does he think that?
It's just a British story. Right then. And, you know, this is the idea that, you know, we never got rid here in the UK for our imperial thinking. That's, you know, thinking we're still an empire and, you know, that the sun never set, as Churchill said, on the British Empire. Well, at the end of the day, we are a middle rank power, an important one with historical connection, you know, for instance, with the Commonwealth, but we don't have the military power anymore. And we should know, and the institutions and the Foreign Office represents more the British foreign policy before 1945, maybe during the early days of the Cold War, but not now. And what is suggested in this report by former three senior diplomats, and it's basically targets more, we gave up on the Tories, let's see what the next government probably will be, Labour, is to project soft power. It's about trade, it's about culture, climate change will be over there. And I think it was endearing also the way we need even to change the pictures in King Charles' house. We need to, so because what is the wall represents more the past than the future.
Absolutely. Yossi, thank you very much indeed. That's Yossi Meckelberg there. Now, here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. Hamas has rejected an Israeli ceasefire proposal made at talks in Cairo, a senior Hamas official said. And Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said a date was set for an invasion of Rafah, but did not reveal when. More than 1 million people are crammed into the southern city in desperate conditions, short of food, water and shelter. And foreign governments and organizations have urged Israel against storming Rafah for fears of a bloodbath. The US ambassador to the United Nations will travel to the heavily armed Korean border and meet North Korean defectors in South Korea amid faltering UN efforts to ensure sanctions enforcement against the North. The trip comes after Russia rejected the annual renewal of the multinational panel of experts, which has, over the past 15 years, worked on the implementation of UN sanctions aimed at curbing North Korea's nuclear and missile programs. And Russia and China will continue to cooperate in the fight against terrorism as part of their ever-strengthening relationship, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said in Beijing today after talks with Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi. During his official visit, Lavrov said Russia-Chinese relations of comprehensive partnership and strategic interaction have reached an unprecedented level. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. It's not often that a completely new currency is introduced, but that's exactly what Zimbabwe has done. Last week, the country with the highest inflation rate in the world was named as one of the worst governed countries in Africa by World Economics, a UK-based research organisation. At the same time, the government of Emmerson Mnangagwa announced a new monetary unit called the ZIG. I'm joined now from Harare by economic analyst Tinashe Murapata. Tinashe, many thanks for joining the program. What is the ZIG?
Thanks, Georgina. So ZIG is a new currency in Zimbabwe that has just been introduced. The last time we had a Zimbabwean dollar currency, it was introduced in 2019. So on its fifth birthday, they saw fit to introduce a new currency. Apparently, this new currency is a gold-backed currency, gold as well as foreign currency reserves-backed currency. So it's linked to the gold and linked to the going exchange rate on the market. This is between the Zimbabwean dollars that are already in the market compared to the gold price. So it's got a new exchange rate that is 1:13.5. So effectively with a new currency, the going outgoing currency was now $1 to 30,000 Zim dollars. This was on the official market. So what they have done is introduced a new currency based or backed by gold, and the new currency exchange rate is 1:18.5.
Does Zimbabwe have the gold reserves to back this?
So far, from the new governor, what we have noted, or what they said, is that they have enough gold to back up to 300 million of the new ZIG. It's called ZIG currency, the new currency. So 300 million, which obviously is not enough, but they see it as a start.
So, I mean, I've just seen an announcement from the Postal and Telecommunications Authority of Zimbabwe. They want to index mobile phone tariffs against the US dollar. Surely that's just accepting that ZIG doesn't work if even a government agency won't accept it?
Well, I think that's the confusion in the market at the moment, that nobody really knows what's going to happen. The governor himself has admitted that 80 to 85% of the economy is dollarized already. And what you're finding with the local currency is only 15% of usage in the domestic market. So I think what the telecommunications regulator is only admitting is that US dollars is the commonly used currency. And anyone who's using a local currency will find that they face, you know, inflation, as you've already indicated, of around 1,600. So you cannot plan with that local currency. And I think it's just an admission of the realities on the ground.
So what can you do with the ZiG? What can you buy?
Well, you'll be able to buy anything, really. They have made it the local currency. So I think that lots of people will trade with the local currency ZiG, primarily because they've reduced the interest rate from about 130% to about 20%. So essentially, lots of people would want to borrow as much in the softer currency as possible and trade in the softer currency and keep their dollars away, tugged somewhere offshore or under their mattresses. So, and the government has also admitted that you can use ZiG to pay your taxes. At least 50% of your taxes can be paid in ZiG. So a lot of local companies will, because I think that when you look at the rate of ZiG on the parallel market, it will always trade at a discount on the official market. So there'll be a lots and lots of arbitrage between what is on the street and what is on the official market. And people will take advantage of that arbitrage.
So we know that in the past, the government has tinkered with the currency basically in order to loot citizens' accounts of US dollars. And you mentioned people keeping it under their mattresses. Is this of concern?
Yes, I think the local currency has unfortunately lost the confidence of the Zimbabwean people, which is not unusual. Anywhere across the world where you suffered hyperinflation, trust and confidence is very low and it's very difficult to get it. And just introducing a new currency is not a way in which you gain that trust and confidence. Effectively, what's on the street, what people are seeing is that they're just simply rebased. So not that it's bagged or linked to gold, but all they've just done is to cancel out the three zeros and divide the outcome by two. That's how you get to 13. So they're just essentially rebased. So the trust and confidence is not there. Mm. But to their credit, they have protected the US dollars in the market. I think that's the one positive thing that they have done. From the previous governor to the new governor, they have protected what we term real US dollars that is in the official market. They have protected that. And they have allowed the usage of the multi-currency system to continue. Whether that will continue for the next 5 years, heaven knows. But so far, they have given that confidence. And for the last 10 years, people have been able to trade in their US dollars. I think the problem is the local currency where they overprint.
Tanasha, the government's distributed at least 100 brand new vehicles to those who helped it in its election campaign. Concurrently, Mnangagwa declared a state of national disaster. He says 2.7 million Zimbabweans need food aid. If the country can't feed itself, how can it hand out new cars to its supporters?
Well, I think we need to perhaps be very clear. We don't have the evidence that the new cars are coming from Treasury. If the new cars are coming from the party, then that has nothing to do with our public policy. What we're concerned about is within the public policy realm, which is Treasury, what the fiscus actually has. And unfortunately, the fiscus has been overspending way above its revenues. Our own calculations is we collect in terms of revenue around about 3.5 to 4 billion US dollars, and we spend close to 7 to 8 billion US dollars, cross subsidies, a lot of quasi-fiscal activities, and that, and electioneering. And that has led to the money printing. And that is the primary problem that we have, that we just simply spend more than we actually collect. What happens at the party, I think that's really what happens at the party. It's got nothing to do with public policy, unless someone can give us evidence that they've been using Treasury to fund party activities.
Tanasha, thank you very much indeed. That's Tanasha Murupata, who is speaking to us from Harare. You're with Monocle Radio. It's 13:39 in Bangkok and 8:39 in Zurich. The military junta in Myanmar is facing its biggest challenge since it overthrew the elected government in 2021. Anti-junta groups have come together and, backed by a pro-democracy parallel government, have seized control of several important areas, including a key town on the border with Thailand. Well, I'm joined now by Bill Hayton, who's Associate Fellow at Chatham House's Asia-Pacific programme and author of A Brief History of Vietnam. Bill, many thanks for coming on the show. We had an in-depth look at Myanmar and how the balance of power is shifting last week. But I wonder if you could bring us up to speed with what happened over the weekend.
Well, this town, Miawadi, is right on the border with Thailand. And it's the crossing point through which most of the Thai-Myanmar trade goes. You know, well over $1 billion of trade passes through there each year. And the fact that it seems to have now fallen to the sort of a coalition of opposition groups, I think, has really spooked the Thai government. Thailand and Myanmar have a border that's sort of 2,000 kilometers long. There are tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of refugees from Myanmar in Thailand. And the government there fears that the fighting will prompt another influx. And it's a border that's very, very easy to cross.
Mm. Now, the Thai government has been making comment about this and talking perhaps about now is the time to speak. What do they mean by that?
Well, I think there's a short-term and a long-term fear here. And the short-term, I think, is that the fear of refugees coming over the border, already starting to see images of people setting up tents along the riverbanks, and reports from the Thai side of fearing 100,000 people may cross. But I think the longer term is actually the potential for the breakup of Myanmar. I mean, historically, the state is dominated by the lowland people, the Bama majority, who live in the kind of lowland rice-growing areas, if you like. And then all around you have these hills with people who are called minorities, people like the Karen and the Shan and the Rakhine peoples. And increasingly, groups linked to those ethnic groups, and armed groups linked to those ethnic groups, are taking control of those border areas. So we've seen this Miawadi operation is in the Karen area. We've seen the Shan forces take over part of Shan state. We've seen success in the Rakhine with the Rakhine people. So there's a kind of potential there that Myanmar could fragment, and that would really sort of lead to a much wider conflict, reopen questions of borders and all the rest of it. So I think there are short-term and long-term things here. And the Thai government, I think, wants to basically try and persuade the army that if they, don't do something now and sit down with the opposition, then the country would fragment.
And do you think that the anti-junta coalition have the firepower necessary to bring down the junta?
Well, they are getting better and better at it, and they've been very, very clever in starting to use drone technology, and that seems to have been part of the reason for the recent military successes. But I mean, at the end of the day, the Myanmar military is large and has artillery and it has fighter jets, so it's able to bring a lot more firepower to bear. But at the moment, it's fighting all around the country, and so I think for the first time, people are starting to think that maybe the junta may not be able to survive. But I think having worked with the junta a long time ago in the sort of transition, it's very hard to overestimate the bloody mindedness of the junta and their desire to remain in charge of the country. So I think they will fight to the bitter end.
And should they lose, would it necessarily mean fragmentation, or could there in fact be a united democratic Myanmar?
Well, there could be, but I mean, even the sort of democratic opposition, I think, has a problem with accepting that there would be a federal state, for example, that gave greater devolution or autonomy to the sort of minority areas. Even Aung San Suu Kyi is somebody who believes, I think, in a unitary state, that there should be a single Myanmar state, and has been reluctant to concede the idea that the groups, the so-called minority groups in the hills, should have greater autonomy. So that's a sort of fault line which that goes through Myanmar politics, not just the military, but also parts of the democratic opposition as well.
Bill, thank you very much indeed. That's Bill Hayton there. And this is The Globalist on Monocle Radio.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
And now it's time for a roundup of climate news with Monocle contributing editor Sheena Rossiter, who joins us now from Edmonton. Morning to you, Sheena.
Good morning.
Now, new data shows that climate records continue to be broken in Europe. What are the figures?
Yeah, well, a recent report that was released by Copernicus Climate Change Service, it's reported that March was the 10th month in a row where global climate surface temperatures have been broken. So temperatures in March, they were reported to have risen a 0.1 degree Celsius, higher than the previous record, which was set all the way back in 2016. But for the past 10 months, month over month, we're seeing record-setting temperatures. This is partly to blame to El Nino, which is a weather system that's behind the recent heat. But also, alarm bells are being raised to see that this could be a tipping point for a new phase where climate change is going to be even faster and accelerating pace. Over the past 12 months, average global temperatures have been rising to 1.58 degrees Celsius pre-industrial levels. And now that number is significant because, as we know, this is currently exceeding the 1.5 degrees Celsius benchmark that was set out in the Paris Climate Change Agreement, which was a landmark agreement. But it's not considered to be breached unless this continues for the next decade.
Right. So, but it's been winter, of course, in the Northern Hemisphere. What could this mean for the summer months?
Well, it could just mean more of those record-breaking heats that temperatures that we saw last year. And also, it's highly likely that there will be more natural disasters. So, for example, where I live in Western Canada in the province of Alberta, we're likely to expect even worse forest fires this summer than we did last year, which were record-breaking during the summer months. And they actually burned into the winter months and started considerably early in the months of May. And other places you're expected to see in the United States, things like droughts and stuff like that are only expected to continue.
Mm. Now, speaking of Canada, the new proposed carbon tax hike's now in place. How are Canadians receiving it?
It's definitely not going over well, especially in the more conservative parts of the country, where we have seen protests already happening since the April 1st tax has been put in place. Here in Alberta, some protesters have taken to driving tractors down the highway that is a pipeline between Edmonton and Calgary, the two major cities here. And they're just effectively trying to do that trucker convoy sort of protest against the tax there. And many Canadians are frustrated with Justin Trudeau's administration and his Liberal government. And they feel that the tax is actually fueling inflation in parts of the country. Whether that's proven to be true or not remains to be seen. And even though the societal costs of climate change are really impacting people in this country, still some 78% of Canadians are actually opposed to this increase on the federal carbon tax.
So it's becoming a political issue.
Absolutely. The political divide is happening between the Conservatives and other Canadians who tend to vote more central and left-leaning parties. And the divide is only growing. Just to give you some numbers, around 90% of Canadians who say they intend to vote for the Liberal Party or the New Democratic Party, which tends to be more left-leaning, they've been telling pollsters that climate change is, in fact, the most caused by human activities. And that's according to the Angus Reid Institute, and that was a survey that they conducted last month in March. But by contrast, about a third of federal Conservative voters in that same poll have said that they accept that this foundational climate fact. And a few more examples go to show that only a quarter of Conservative voters, they think that last summer's forest fires were linked to climate change. And by contrast, Liberal voters, that number is at about 80%. And left-leaning New Democratic Party voters, that number sitting at 82% that believe the forest fires were connected to climate change.
So then why such contempt for the tax hike?
Yeah, this is really interesting. A lot has been written about this, namely pointing to behavior. So over time, behavioral scientists have long said that people tend to have stronger emotions and they have stronger emotional responses when they're losing as opposed to gains. So even though the gains that could be avoided from having this carbon tax, by not having more climate disasters, are much greater than the cost of carbon pricing. Some estimates put it at about 3.3 cents. It's still hard to switch that perspective. So Canada is really a unique outlier in that respect.
Mm. Is it the same story in the US?
Actually, it's quite different in the U.S. at the moment. So right now in the United States, there actually is quite a bit of pressure on the Biden administration to act on this climate disclosure. So 26 members of Congress are basically urging agencies to finalize what the rules would be in order to leverage the market in, you know, cutting greenhouse gas emissions. So this was a pledge that was put out by Joe Biden in an effort to renew this international leadership on climate change, something that didn't really happen too much under the Donald Trump administration. So what the administration is looking at doing is they're looking to get some of the biggest contractors to set new carbon reduction targets that would align themselves with the Paris Agreement. And the U.S. is making a $700 billion pledge in purchasing decisions annually to get these new rules for thousands of businesses into place. And this announcement did come quite some time ago, 16 months ago to be exact, when Biden announced it in Egypt at COP27 in 2022. And now the election is just around the corner, so a lot of congressional Democrats are pressing to get this finalized to go through. Industry is on boards. Companies like Verizon and Microsoft and Pfizer, just to name a few, are interested in this. But the U.S. Chamber of Commerce isn't. And they've stated that this would be costly. And they've even gone as far as saying that it could pose a threat to national security.
Hmm. Listen, there's been an enormous event in the skies. Tell us about the solar eclipse.
Yeah, so on a lighter note, we did have a solar eclipse across North America yesterday. It went all the way from Canada to Mexico, and it was completely the talk of the town. Everybody was out with their protective eyewear on to catch a glimpse. Of course, not in all parts of the continent was it a total eclipse, but in places like Nebraska, Arkansas, and Alabama, people traveled for miles upon miles to go see that total eclipse, and there were quite a few viewing parties happening yesterday all over the continent. And of course, some climate activists, like members of the Climate Defense, they did use the solar eclipse to raise awareness about climate change issues. And that was in Burlington, Vermont yesterday. So definitely many people out there and a lot of people checking it out.
Absolutely. And lots of proposals and weddings and things, I understand. Sheena, thank you very much indeed. That's Sheena Rossiter there. And you're listening to The Globalist on Monocle Radio. Over the past few years, some thought the future of the hospitality industry might have been uncertain. But for one particular hotelier, that statement couldn't be further from the truth. Felicity Black-Roberts is the Vice President of Development and Acquisitions for Europe at Hyatt. And she spoke to Monocle's Editor-in-Chief, Andrew Tuck, about the state of the industry and the growth the group has experienced. They met at Hyatt's own Hotel Martinez in Cannes on the sidelines of the property festival MIPIM. Andrew started by asking Felicity about the amazing pace of openings of late and how they select which of the Hyatt's brands to put in each location.
Hyatt's name in Europe has always been very strong, but we had a huge distribution problem in that we were very strong in North America and very strong in the Far East, but we didn't have a coverage of the key European markets. And so that's been something that we've very specifically targeted to make sure that we have that distribution. We really like to go into a city first with one of our what we call hard brands, so something with Hyatt up front in the name, Hyatt Regency, Hyatt Place, Park Hyatt, for example. That's usually the type of opportunity that we're looking for when we enter a city. And then often we will then follow through with some of our softer brands. So like Hotel Martinez, an Unbound collection by Hyatt, where the hotel is leading as opposed to Hyatt leading in the name. But we've been quite opportunistic in order to fulfill our strategy to get the coverage that we wanted across Europe. We've now got the capital cities, we're now moving into secondary cities, we're looking at different segments within the cities where we're now present, and of course we're expanding our leisure portfolio.
One of the interesting things you told us earlier on was that actually, the world of business travel has not gone away at all and is pretty robust here in Europe. Are you surprised how robust it has remained? Because everyone in the pandemic was like, okay, this is over, there'll be no more business travel ever. Did you keep your wits about you then as well?
We were surprised at how well the sector bounced back, both in terms of the people who are willing to invest and the travellers who are coming to our hotels. And yes, I was faced with a number of those doom merchants, you know, there's never going to be another Frankfurt Book Fair and it's all dead. And it's come back, and it's a testimony to how human beings want to do business. They want to be face-to-face, have eye contact, be in the same room. And we really see that that facilitates the way we do business. So why would it be different for the people who are using our hotels?
Now, one of the nice things that seems to be happening is people booking suites rather than just individual rooms.
I think people coming out of the pandemic really realised how much they'd valued travel. And so people have been going out. There's been a lot of leisure trips. There's also been a lot of blended trips where people might be taking their family away. They're also doing some work as part of that. And I think that's partly driven the demand for suites. I think people have been treating themselves. But I do think people now want, when they go away, an experience. And I think a suite often delivers on that experience for those high-end guests who can afford that pricing level.
So I own a nice, big, classic hotel. I want to be part of a bigger group. I see the benefits from that. What are the kinds of things that you're asking of hotels before they can begin to think about putting a Hyatt badge on their property? How deep is the involvement of Hyatt when you take on one of these deals?
So it differs between managed and franchised. I guess what is the same for every deal is we want to make sure that the characteristics of the hotel, whether it's something that's going to be built or it's an existing hotel, are going to match the characteristics of the brand that people recognise and come to Hyatt for. So whenever we take a hotel into our portfolio, we want to see changes to the hotel that mean it will match our brand characteristics. Sometimes a hotel already matches brand characteristics. Sometimes it's ready for a refurbishment and a repositioning. So every time it's different. And it's really creating that relationship, going back to what we were saying about being in a room as opposed to being on a camera, is creating a relationship with the owner or the potential franchisee to understand what their objective is for their hotel and how we can match that and make the Hyatt brand work for them and create value ultimately.
Well, Felicity, trends as you see it within the hotel sector, what should people be aware is shifting and changing?
Hyatt as a company, we're moving much towards taking what we've learned from our lifestyle brands like Andaz and Thompson and layering those into our other brands like Regency. I think leisure is something that we've got to keep an eye out for. Blending leisure and business travel is something that everybody's talking about now. And I think as we move forward, it's really about how do we make every square meter of a building sing and create value for the owner. So really big focus on food and beverage is my prediction for the future.
And finally, we're always got an eye on what's happening in the urban environment, which cities are on the up. You look across Europe. When you're putting pins in the map these days of potential projects, where are you eyeing up?
We have so many places where we're not currently still in Europe that we love all of our locations equally. I think Spain is particularly hot at the moment. But to your point, I think there's some really interesting projects we're seeing in embryonic stages, resort-style projects in Scandinavia, so really experiential type leisure resorts. And it will be interesting to see if they can get funding and we can get those off the ground, because I think they'd be nice places to visit.
That was Felicity Black-Roberts in conversation with Monocle's Andrew Tuck. And that's all for today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Vincent McAvinney and Laura Kramer, our researcher, George Ruskin, and our studio manager, Steph Chungu. After the headlines, there's more music on the way, and the briefing is live at midday in London. And of course, our broadcasting continues round the clock. You can always download any of the programmes from our archives to listen to at a time convenient to you. Monocle on Saturday, for instance, we told you all about an exciting event with Romani writers and musicians happening at the British Library this evening, and we also discussed a new opera that's just opened in Kansas City. Just a couple of things that you can listen to from our archives. I'm Georgina Godwin. I'll be back on The Globalist at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.